Typically, mean velocity is more suited to your strength type exercises, so your non-ballistic type exercises, so bench, deadlifts, squat, etc. And peak velocity is more suited to your explosive, powerful exercises.
Hi, Steve. It's my pleasure to have you on Evidence Strong Show. If you could briefly introduce yourself.
Hi, Alex. Thank you very much for inviting me on. I'm looking forward to chatting to you today. My name's Dr. Steve Thompson. I'm a senior lecturer at Sheffield Hallam University in the UK. I've been in sort of academia and research for 10, 12 years now. I passed my PhD in 2022, obviously majoring in velocity-based training and load velocity profiling and its ability to predict 1RM. And I'm also a practicing S&C coach. So I've been accredited for a similar amount of time and I'm currently working with British Diving, where we had some successful medalists at the Paris Olympics just gone. And I also work as a physical performance coach for the English Football Association as well.
Awesome. Huge credentials. I'm very excited to have you. And we'll be talking about velocity training. So let's start with the basics. Why velocity training? Why should we care?
Yeah, good question. Why should we care? So velocity-based training is a tool that strength and conditioning coaches and sports scientists have available to them to help inform what they do from a training and a testing perspective. So by utilizing velocity, we get objective data to help determine someone's physical status or physiological status on any given day. We can also use it as a means to manipulate load, to auto-regulate, to drive intent, to help with programming and prescription and optimize the things that our athletes do in the gym. You know, most you'll be aware, and I'm sure most of your listeners will be aware of the different auto-regulatory strategies that are out there, repetitions in reserve, RPE, different predictive equations. And for me, velocity is the best of that bunch, really. It's objective. It gives us data. It's pretty reliable. It's pretty valid. And it has a clear and direct link to our neuromuscular function. So from my perspective, which obviously is a biased one, I stand by those biases. And I truly believe that velocity as a tool for improving the way we prescribe, program, test and monitor, I think it's the best out there.
All right. So you kind of mentioned what the goal would be. So goals can be different. So this is a diverse tool that can be used in different ways.
So I always break it down into sort of six different categories. The main six roles and responsibilities outside of coaching that an S&C coach typically has to undergo or think about. So we've got our testing, whereby you could apply some form of low velocity profile, which is the most common and most popular from a research perspective. We've got monitoring, where you might do some simple tracking of velocity to just identify sort of that physiological status, readiness to train type approach. We've got programming, so being able to set velocity zones and targets to help athletes understand where and what they should be lifting. We've got kind of the prediction, the auto-regulation, whereby we might either predict 1RM or we might do a bit more of a bespoke, simple approach to load manipulation and, you know, adjusting the load on the bar based on the velocities that we're seeing. We've then got kind of fatigue monitoring, volume control through velocity loss. And then the final one, which is arguably the most impactful, but unfortunately the least researched, is that feedback that you can get from velocity and the ability to drive intent and competition and just create a really healthy environment within the weight room. And, you know, these are all at the disposal of the S&C coach and what they feel is appropriate for a given person, a given block of training, or a given sort of environment that they're working within. And I think you can kind of jump between all of them. You know, you could argue that using all six is best case scenario, is best practice. I think best practice is whatever works for where you coach and where you train. The way I normally try to describe it is you can kind of, those six categories can kind of be split into two. You've got those that are ready to go. So kind of pick up the technology, stick it on the bar and just start using it. So there's no prerequisite profiling or testing required. And then there's the bits you can do that are a bit more invasive or require a little bit more detail and depth that would follow on from doing that kind of profiling. So if we start with the bang for your buck, easy stuff to just pick up, you know, plug and go stuff, the feedback is the first. So as I mentioned, feedback is where you're in a gym and you're doing whatever exercise and you're simply feeding back the velocities to that individual in order to provide a bigger output, a bigger mechanical output. And anybody that's that's used EVT will have seen the positive impact that that can have on an environment. So from my perspective, it's something that can be done really, really easily and can have a big impact straight away, because it can help athletes understand, you know, intent. Certainly from a younger perspective, you start to give them some targets, or you start to sort of say, okay, that last rep was 1.02, and you get 1.05, and they do it and they think, oh, okay, now I understand what driving intent might feel like. I thought I was doing it, but perhaps I wasn't. But then you can also use it to create a really healthy environment. So if you're working in a team setting or you know, a squad setting where there's lots of people training all at the same time, you can create leaderboards, or you can split the leaderboards up so it's fair. You could do it by relative strength or whatever you decided was an appropriate way of breaking down the squad. And you can chase some velocities and create this healthy environment, either with peers or even with oneself. And there's research out there. There's a meta-analysis by Jonathan Weekly and his research team that kind of looked at all of those different feedback-related studies and found that velocity can help to improve performance. And performance is defined by output, so mechanical output, typically through measurement of velocity. But simply giving that feedback can improve performance by 8%, which is quite a lot, I think. Certainly, if you're working with the upper echelons of performance, I think trying to find 8% improvement would make a big difference. So from my perspective, the feedback aspect of VBT is the easiest to implement and potentially has the biggest bang for your buck. So I would definitely implore everybody, just give it a go, that invest in VBT.
Okay, we went through feedback. What would be the next one easy to use?
So I think from a monitoring perspective, there's some real simple testing as well, actually. There's some real simple things we can do that often get overlooked. I think the first is the idea of readiness to train. So the reason I like velocity is, as I mentioned earlier, it has kind of like direct link with neuromuscular function. If you think about force equals mass times acceleration and how we break that down and how we split that down, any kind of force or velocity measurement directly links to what's happening physiologically. If you think about force velocity relationships, how that links to how a muscle shortens and lengthens, there is clear relationships with that type of information versus what's happening physiologically. So I really like that. It gives me confidence in what I'm seeing. So, you know, real simple readiness to train, instead of jumping and looking at jump height or looking at a different metric, looking at takeoff velocity or peak velocity or even mean velocity can give you a real simple indication as to whether someone's coming in fatigued or not. And I never go as far as saying, if your velocity drops by X amount, we're going to strip this amount of load out, because I don't think it works like that. But I think what it does do is it sparks a conversation between coach and athlete to say, right, what's going on? Why are your numbers down? How did you sleep? How are you eating? How's your stress levels, etc.? Do you think we need to modify today? And if the answer is yes, then you use your coaching ability and coaching intuition just to figure out what that modification should look like. Just one thing on the testing element is more around some simple testing. And it goes back to Newtonian laws of F equals mass times acceleration. And if you think about how we typically test strength, so 1RM testing, for example, you know, I have no problem. I 1RM test my athlete, and I think it's a very good, reliable, valid method of understanding someone's maximal capacity. And I think it should definitely be complemented in any of the auto-regulation stuff that we do. But I do think there are environments where 1RM testing is unfeasible, impractical. And therefore, in order to track strength development, you could quite easily pick an arbitrary load, let's call it 100 kilograms. And you could, at the start of the intervention or a training block, you could measure their velocity. At the end of the training block, you do exactly the same load and you measure their velocity. And if we think about what force equals mass times acceleration actually means, we know that mass is fixed, so mass doesn't change. We know that acceleration is a byproduct of velocity. And therefore, if acceleration or velocity goes up, we know that force goes up, force underpins strength. Hey presto, we have got stronger. Obviously, we can't necessarily quantify that as much as we would like to with a 1RM and start readjusting loads, etc. But as a real simple testing strategy, we can determine whether that intervention has been successful or not. And at least we have some data where in previous, we might not have taken that because we haven't got access to this technology. So for me, it's a real simple method that, again, gets overlooked and often isn't used as a testing strategy.
All right, so we covered three: feedback, testing, and monitoring.
The other one on the sort of the plug and play is this idea of velocity loss. So velocity loss is a way of individualizing volume prescription. So for those that are unaware of what velocity loss is, it's basically a way of determining when a set should finish. So instead of saying you're going to do 5 sets of 5 repetitions, you might say you're going to do 5 sets, but you're going to stop the set when your velocity has dropped by 10, 20, 30, 40%, whatever it might be. And what this does is it individualizes the volume prescription. So we know, and research has shown, that at a given load, individuals lift different repetition numbers. So you and I at 85% in a squat will lift different numbers to failure, different numbers of repetition. And therefore, we individualize the load, the intensity, by doing 1RM, calculating 1RM, at percentages of 1RM, making sure that's what's on the bar. But then we say, now go and do 5x5 or 6x3 or whatever it might be. And it's very blanket prescription based on what we've learned through our careers as coaches and within academia and research. And the reason I like velocity loss is because it takes away that generalized approach. And actually now it says, yes, you're going to work to the same percentage, but now you're going to do the amount of work that right for you in terms of your physiological state, your strength levels, your training history, etc., etc. So I think velocity loss, and again, is something that you can just pick up. You don't need to do any profiling prior. You can just pick it up, stick it on the bar, and as long as you understand the relationship between the percentage drop and the physiology, then you're off to a winner. And on that, then I think everybody listening would think it's common sense that the higher the threshold, the more repetitions you're going to do, the more muscular breakdown, more of a metabolic response, the more of a hypertrophic response you're going to get. The smaller the threshold, less reps, less fatigue, potentially more strength development, more targeting of power, tapering and priming close to competition. And then there's kind of that spectrum and that continuum as to where you might sit based on the adaptation that you're trying to achieve. So again, a real simple method for individualizing the volume prescription, which I think is an important thing that again often gets overlooked.
Could you go through the example? So following on what you suggested before, let's say I have some sets to do at 85%. Now, how you would use the velocity loss to guide the prescription?
Yeah, so if you're in a strength block, let's take block periodization as a real simple way of breaking it down. So that first block, accumulation, hypertrophy kind of goal response, you're looking at the higher end. So you're looking at anywhere between 30 and 40-45% velocity loss. Research suggests that 40 to 45% is pretty close to where failure would be from a velocity perspective. And obviously, there are lots of research coming out more recently that suggests actually training for failure isn't as effective for strength and hypertrophy developments than not training to failure. So having a little bit in the tank is probably worthwhile, but you're going to get a lot more mechanical and metabolic responses from doing that larger amount of work. So yeah, 30 to 40% is that accumulation block, that hypertrophy block. Strength then is going to be around 20 to 25, 30%. So that's your transmutation. And then for your realization block, which is obviously a bit more of an explosive power focus, you're looking around 10%. I think when you're then going closer to competition, if we're in kind of an Olympic sport, for example, and we get into that peaking and that tapering strategy, I would probably be looking at 5%. Now, 5% might only be 1 rep or 2 reps, but that's probably what we want at that given time because of how proximity to competition. So that's how I would typically break it down. And that's based off a lot of research. It's not just me making it up. That's kind of all over the place with velocity loss research.
Thank you. That's very helpful. All right, fatigue covered. Now we have, do I remember correctly, programming and prediction, 2 more than.
Yeah, so I suppose we probably need to just go back to the testing element because this is where profiling comes in. So obviously the paper that I recently published with my colleagues, a big part of that was around load velocity profiling. And load velocity profiling is an area of research that is heavily researched these days. There is lots out there, which is good and also not so good sometimes. But load velocity profiling is essentially an incremental protocol. It's no different to a 1RM. However, you might start a little bit lighter. You might go up in more sensible increments. So let's say you start at 30% 1RM and go up to 110% increments. You wouldn't do that if you were just doing a 1RM. You might start at 50, go to 70, 80, etc. And so there's maybe a few more increments involved, and every lift is done with maximal intent and velocity. But apart from that, it's an incremental protocol. It's exactly the same as a 1RM. So I think firstly, it's important to note that sometimes there is this conflict between velocity capacity-based training advocate, percentage 1RM advocates, and it's almost like the two don't go together, when I think that's just madness. They absolutely should go together and should always go together. They are very complementary. So if we're going to do our 1RM test, great, get that data, but then why not track the velocity on the lower loads as well and get that data at the same time? If we're going to prescribe percentage of 1RM, great, that's how we learn, that's how we understand where adaptations sit, but use the velocity to help guide the prescriptions at the same time. So I think that there's definitely a strong marriage there that needs to be acknowledged. So from a profiling perspective, you are picking a key exercise, you are doing the incremental protocol, you're measuring velocity alongside the load that's being lifted, and then you're simply plotting load on the X, velocity on the Y. Once you do that, you plot a predictive equation, so a linear regression or a second order polynomial line through it, gives you an equation. You then use that equation for whatever you need to use it for. That's load velocity profiling in a nutshell. And profiling is great for real in-depth understanding of force velocity characteristics. We can look at how someone changes off the back of interventions in more depth than just have they got stronger. We can look at have they got faster, have they got stronger at lighter loads, at heavier loads, how does the whole profile shift? Does it shift all up and to the right? Does one bit move? Does another bit move? We get a little bit more information, which I think is really important. But the main thing we can use the profiling for then is programming. So we can then start to use and set really bespoke, individualized targets for our athletes to say, right, if you're going to lift 85% 1RM, that equates to 100 kilograms for you and also equates to 0.5 meters per second. Great. So then when that athlete goes into the gym, they know firstly, okay, I know I need 100 kg on the bar, but it should be lifted at 0.5 meters per second done maximally. If for whatever reason that 100k is faster or slower, well, we can then decide whether we need to adjust that load, that manipulate the load, so auto-regulate. And what that allows the athlete to do is to become a little bit more intuitive and a little bit more self-aware of their own training. So they become a little bit more, have a bit a better ownership of their own training, because instead of now saying, going to the coach, oh, I don't feel great, should I drop it a bit? They can use the data themselves. They know they should be at 0.5. It's now coming out at 0.4. Well, then they know they need to take a little bit off to hit that zone that's been set by the coach. So I think that can be a really powerful tool, not only in optimizing prescriptions, but in educating athletes at the same time in terms of taking ownership of their own training. The only downfall is you have to have the time and the resource to be able to go through the profile. Every exercise has its own profile. So it's not one profile fits all, and every individual has their own profile. So if you are working with a big squad, it becomes a little bit more difficult to manage that. There are options out there, you know, that quite heavily researched. Is what's called a two-point method, whereby you take two distal points within a profile. So you might do 40% and 85%, and you get those two loads and those two velocities, and you draw the line through and you can then calculate the rest of the spectrum. Great in upper body exercises, great in Smith machine exercises, from what I've seen and what I've experienced, not the best lower body freeway exercises. I think you need a few more loads. So one of my pieces of research from my PhD looked at a four-point method within a back squat and a combined back squat jump squat, which had some real good success. So I think it's definitely doable from a prescription perspective, but the accuracy of the prediction on a two-point method is not always 100% now.
Could you speak a little bit more on the testing of back squat and jump squat, did you say?
Yeah, so I kind of acknowledge that when we profile, let's say we profile a back squat, we often try and get the lighter load, so anything as low as 20-30% perhaps. But we're asking individuals, athletes, to back squat 20% at maximal intent and velocity. And if you've ever tried doing that, it feels very weird. It's very difficult to control. The reliability of the data at that, in such a light load, because of that deceleration phase you get because you're not leaving the ground, and that sort of braking phase in a non-ballistic exercise, I think it had a big impact on what the data actually looked like. So we tested and researched a combination of doing a jump squat, but a full jump squat, so full descent as you would the back squat, and then just accelerate through and off the ground from 0% to 60% 1RM, and then we continued with the back squat. Took a combination of those in order to predict 1RM and found that was far more successful than just doing back squat alone.
Sorry, do you plot it on one load velocity curve?
Yes. So you work off percentages of back squat 1RM, but you would simply jump at the lighter loads and you would still do full descent, just accelerate all the way through and leave the ground at those lighter loads and plot it. And actually what you find is it now becomes more of a curved line. So you apply a second order polynomial instead of a linear regression, and the predictions were much, much better. So it's something that I always try and use and try and advocate for when I'm talking to people about profiling.
Do you use mean or peak velocity?
Mean, yeah. I always try to use mean from a profiling perspective because, again, it's just a slightly more stable metric. Peak velocity, if depending on the technology and depending on the way it's been done, can sometimes throw out some erroneous data, which then just broke off the profile a little bit.
Could you speak a little bit more about peak and mean velocity and when you would use which one and why?
Yeah, so typically mean velocity is more suited to your strength type exercises, so your non-ballistic type exercises, so bench, deadlifts, squat, etc. And peak velocity is more suited to your explosive, powerful exercises. So maybe weightlifting derivatives, loaded jumps, if you use any kind of unloaded jumps as well. I think that's fine. I think that works. And I agree that's how it's typically used. I would always look at mean velocity, whatever the exercise, because from my perspective, mean velocity is a more stable metric. And I think it's important that you look at the more stable metric as well, just in case peak velocity starts to throw out some of that erroneous data that I mentioned. But they are both perfectly viable, have their place. And as I mentioned, kind of suited to the different types of exercises that we would typically do within a gym. But I think it's important just to keep your eye on the mean velocity, whatever the exercise, just so you know that the data looks right.
Should we go into prediction first?
So the idea of 1RM prediction is based off a profile whereby you do a submaximal profile. So you don't need to take someone up to 1RM, and you utilize the equation that I mentioned in order to extrapolate to where that 1RM would be. So essentially you could do a full profile 1RM test and figure out someone's velocity at 1RM. Then the next session, you do a submaximal profile of maybe two or three loads, plug in where the velocity should be for their 1RM and extrapolate down and predict what your 1RM would be for that given day. Now, I've seen it be done very well, and I've done it myself very well in terms of the approach, but I've also seen it be done very poorly and, you know, found some remarkable predictions of 1RM. And I think coaches need to be wary of using it religiously, because it can often, if one thing isn't quite right, one lift is done not with maximal intent, or there's some issue with the technology, it can throw the predictions completely off. And it's something that then has a much bigger impact further down the line. So I often advocate the more acute load manipulation based on the profile that I described it earlier, in terms of get your full profile, learn, you know, figure out what loads you want to lift at, and then essentially figure out what that velocity should be, and then put a little zone around it. So let's say your target is 0.5 meters per second. You might go 0.03 the side. So you've got from 0.47 to 0.53. There's your zone. Stay in that zone for all of your sets. If you come out of it, take a little bit off, but put a little bit on. And I think that's a much simpler way of auto-regulating than trying to use fancy equations and potentially troublesome equations to predict what your actual 1RM could be on that given day. I think the other thing is those predictions need to be done at the start of every session. That's time consuming. It could take 15-20 minutes to do it. And if you've only got 45 to 60 minutes with a full squad, it's just not feasible. So I think there are, and this is coming from someone, by the way, who studied this as their part of their PhD. And I now sort of suggest maybe not that worth it. And I did it for 5.5 years. So, you know, it's not coming from any bias, negative bias. It's from experience of sort of thinking, well, is it the best way of doing it? And I don't think it's the simplest way, that's for sure. I think there's other ways that we have the same kind of impact without having to go through the same process at every start of every session and then trust some equations that perhaps are not always going to be as valid as we hoped.
What would be your comment on trying to predict, for example, with athletes who cannot do 1RM testing, do a block with them and then try to predict at the end of the block whether they got stronger in, let's say, back squat.
Yeah, I think that's, again, a viable option. Like I said at the very start of this recording, VBT is very flexible. And if you're working with athletes who, for whatever reason, can't do 1RM testing, then you have to think of a way around that. And prediction might be that. I think one of the ways that it can obviously work is if you are working with individual athletes and you have a little bit more time. But I think that there's a whole host of research out there that we can try and utilize. So while we want to individualize as much as we possibly can, if you're not able to do that, for whatever reason, there's going to be some research out there that has breakdowns of velocity zones and velocity targets based on percentages of 1RM in a population that's probably very similar to the one that you're working in, that you could maybe think, well, let's cut out the middleman and let's just take that data. The whole point of the profile from a programming perspective is to set targets and zones. So if we have that data already and we're kind of fairly confident that the population is similar enough that we can be confident that those velocity targets are going to be not too far away, well, why don't we just use that and let's save some time? So there are lots of ways to do it. There are lots of ways to use VBT successfully. There are a few ways to use it unsuccessfully, but I think trying to keep it as simple as possible is definitely the place to start and then build out on top of it. Don't go sort of bowling in with the one arm predictions and full profiles if you've never picked up a VBT device before. Just have a play around first.
What have you seen coaches doing wrong in terms of using VBT?
The thing that I'm mindful of the most, and this came out of that qualitative research that I did as part of my PhD, is that coaches don't become iPad coaches. That was a big drawback that came out of that research, that you then become so ingrained in the technology, head in an iPad, looking at the data, you forget to coach. And I think that's a big part of what we do. S&C coaches are there to work with athletes in person, make sure that they are moving right, lifting right, doing the right things in the right way, building those relationships. If you've got your head in an iPad, that then suffers. So I think that's one bit, is either use it at the right times. So pick one or two exercises, use it for those and then put it away, or educate your athletes to be able to use it themselves so that you can be then in that environment and be coaching, etc., and not having to worry about what the technology is telling us. I think that's probably the main sort of cautionary piece of advice I would give.
Awesome, thank you.
There are lots and lots of things that we can do. You can be extremely invasive and fully immersive with VBT, and every little bit has some kind of data attached to it. And if that works, that's what your athletes like, then go for it. I think, you know, brilliant. But be mindful that not every athlete likes data. Not every athlete likes using technology. And I think being mindful of that as well is important, to remember that there's a person behind the device or the underneath the barbell that needs to be brought into that conversation and that decision as to how and when it's used.
Awesome. You made me excited about VBT. So
great.
All right. Two short questions to finish. The first one is, what is your favorite lift?
Favorite lift? Back squat.
Why is that?
It's just something I've always loved doing. Do it every session if I can. It makes me, from a movement perspective, I feel good after doing it. It's one that I always sort of able to get stuck into, and yeah, I'd say it's the pretty staple of any kind of S&C program.
Sounds about right. If people want to follow your work, see what you're up to, maybe ask a question, where they should go online to find you?
Yep. So you can contact me on X. So that's, my handle is @Steve381. I do have an Instagram account, SteveThompson99T. Not necessarily, I don't use it for work that much, but I'm happy for people to reach out on there. Or email is always fine as well, which we can put on the show notes or whatever.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you so much, Steve. It was a pleasure.
Bro, thanks, Alex. Appreciate it.